Jim Caruso, we are on episode 6 of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? And this time, once again, I am surrounded by my former bosses. We have Ambassador Ted Osius, who was my boss in Vietnam, as you were mine in Australia. Ted is now the president and CEO of the U.S. ASEAN Business Council. And Ted, as you know, we have a gig, we have a bit that we do, which is to ask you a standard question. So I have the honor of the first question, and that is, who is the best military attaché you ever saw, and why was it Ray Powell?
It was definitely Ray Powell. It was a pleasure to work with you, and it's actually really fun to talk with you today.
Well, I'm not going to ask the same question about econ officers because I fear the answer.
But hey, Jim, I recruited you. I reached out to you. I begged to have you come to Jakarta, so you know the answer.
You're young and impressionable, Ted. Anyway, Ted was my boss in Jakarta. He was the deputy chief of mission.
We got a lot done.
We did.
We managed to get a lot done in Indonesia.
We did. But now you're in a position to get all sorts of things done with the private sector, which is always a challenge for us in Jakarta and everywhere else. So I thought we'd start off as we start off every one of these podcasts, trying to help people understand, why should we care about Southeast Asian economies and trade and investment there?
Well, first of all, because they're big and growing. And in fact, I would make an assertion that for the next 30 years, the centers of global growth will be Southeast Asia and India. So they'll play the role that China played for the last 30 years in pushing global growth. So companies are very focused on Southeast Asia and India. They see opportunities, and the countries of Southeast Asia actually see some opportunities in the tensions that exist between the United States and China. They recognize that a lot of multinationals don't want to be overexposed in China, want to diversify, and the natural place to diversify to are the countries that are nearby, India, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, and we're actually beneficiaries of that. There are more demands for our services than ever. And if you want, I don't know if you want statistics, but I can give you a few. I mean, the growth is quite phenomenal in the region.
So the growth of the GDPs or the growth of U.S. investment or both?
Both. U.S. investment is already high. We, ASEAN, the nations of Southeast Asia, are the number one destination for U.S. investment in the Indo-Pacific. And in fact, our companies have invested more in Southeast Asia than in China, India, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan combined.
Wow.
And Southeast Asia collectively is now the fifth largest economy on the planet and it will soon be the fourth largest economy. And so the investment numbers are very large. The trade numbers are large and growing larger. I think it's $508 billion annually that the U.S. and ASEAN exchange. ASEAN is a top five destination for our food and agricultural exports. You've got more than 6,000 U.S. companies operating in Southeast Asia. Many of them have their headquarters in Singapore. I used to work at the Google headquarters in Singapore. The digital economy is growing. It's the fastest growing digital economy on the planet. It could be worth $1 trillion by 2030. If current trends hold, it's now a center. I think ASEAN is now a center of a lot of internet innovation, including innovation in AI. And it's really critical when it comes to global supply chains. So we receive enormous number of semiconductors from Southeast Asia. Malaysia kind of leads in this. But $30 billion worth of chips were exported from ASEAN to the United States in 2022. And when, during COVID, Malaysia slowed down that production, people were laid off in Detroit. They couldn't produce cars if they couldn't get the chips into them. There's a direct link between what's happening in ASEAN and what's happening in the U.S. economy. And it's becoming more significant by the day. So you see huge effort on the part of Vietnam and Philippines to build up their ecosystem to design and produce semiconductors, and a lot of support from the U.S. government. We don't want to be too reliant on Taiwan. We certainly don't want to be reliant on China. And so the natural place to look for diversifying supply chains is Southeast Asia.
So, Ted, that gets to my question, which is, why Southeast Asia? What is it about Southeast Asia that is driving all of this growth?
One thing, we're welcome there. If you're my counterpart who runs the U.S.-China Business Council, they can only get meetings with ministers if they show up with CEOs. I can show up with senior execs, and we will get in to see the prime minister, the president of each country of ASEAN. They want our investment. They're used to getting American investment, and they all want more. So there's a virtuous cycle in place where the ASEAN countries are competing to attract U.S. investment, competing to bring more American business into their countries. They're competing with each other, and they know they're competing with China and India. And now, actually, the Japanese and the Koreans are really kicking in. They're investing more in ASEAN, Australia as well. So you have, I think, a very good cycle where the ASEAN nations want to be more integrated with the nations of the West. They don't want their economies to be dominated by that of China. And they get more options if they're engaging with us and with Japan, Korea, Australia, et cetera.
You know, there are some folks in the U.S. that say every dollar that goes investing outside the U.S. is a dollar not invested in the U.S. and we should just export everything.
Well, we can't. I mean, I don't buy that. We can't export everything. The global economy is too complex. We have to rely on supply chains that go beyond our borders, and that's okay. One of the big advantages of being the United States is that we have a lot of friends, partners, allies around the globe. One of our competitors that I think about a lot, which is China, you know, they've got North Korea and they've got Pakistan. When it comes to alliances, they have been very active in Southeast Asia, investing and trying to integrate supply chains with Southeast Asia. In some ways, that makes Southeast Asia kind of ground zero for the economic competition between the United States and China. But I would maintain that we are more secure economically and in terms of our overall security if those relationships are really strong. And I'm happy that we're actually really investing in friends, partners, and allies in the region more than we have in the past.
So, Ted, when I left Vietnam in 2016, we were about to consummate the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And Vietnam was, of course, very excited about that, as were you as the ambassador. And obviously we know that didn't exactly happen. So what was the result of that? What happened and what did it cost us?
It was a huge disappointment to me and to many others. I think it was an own goal. We had a chance to conclude the most far-reaching, high-standard trade agreement that had ever been concluded. And I've spent 2 years of my life, you know, negotiating with the Vietnamese, trying to bring them in to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And we had succeeded. We'd gotten them in. And in fact, along with it, we'd gotten the strongest human rights agreement we had ever nailed down with Vietnam as a side letter to the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, and we threw it away. And I think it was a strategic blunder of epic proportions. I think of Ash Carter, when he was defense secretary, saying, "I need Trans-Pacific Partnership more than I need more aircraft carriers." He understood the strategic value of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, and we threw it away. And the great beneficiary was China. It was a bad move on our part. We still have not recovered fully from that mistake. It was interesting to me one of the things that happened, the guy I had negotiated the most with to bring Vietnam in was the prime minister at the time, Nguyen Tan Dung, and he lost his job. He had invested a lot and a number of things happened and he lost his job. And I went to see him afterwards. I really just wanted to say, look, I'm sorry. You crawled out on a limb and we cut the limb off. And personally, I'm sorry that we did this. And he said, Ted, it's okay. We're going to find other ways to keep deepening our economic relationship. Well, you know, we'll manage. He didn't spend a lot of time worrying about what we'd done. He was thinking in a forward fashion. And that's what most Southeast Asians do. They're looking to the future, you know, thinking about, okay, we made some mistakes, but let's move forward. Let's find some other way. Now, we have not been able to move forward and once again conclude an agreement of that level. Where right now we've got the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is not as strong as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and we haven't even been able to conclude the trade pillar of that framework. There's other stuff at work that I think is effective and is making a difference in the areas of green energy transition, anti-corruption, supply chain resiliency. We've made some progress in a number of areas, but we're not in as strong a position as we were. And we aren't setting the trade agenda the way we used to. So we're relying on Japan and Singapore and other countries in the region to set the trade agenda. And we're not part of the two biggest trading arrangements in Asia right now. We're not part of the CPTPP, which is the successor to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And we're not part of RCEP, which is a huge trading bloc that does not include the United States.
So, you know, Ted, what are American companies doing? You're the head of the largest business organization of American companies in the region. How have they responded to us in the U.S. not being part of these arrangements?
Our businesses would like us to be in TPP. They wish that we would, since we couldn't join TPP, that we would join the comprehensive, the CPTPP, the successor to the TPP. They would like to have us negotiating ironclad trade agreements that include market access provisions. They'd like us to be setting standards in the region, so setting the rules of trade when it comes to digital. And the United States is not doing that right now. And so there's a certain level of disappointment. I think this is not fatal. We're still the biggest investors and the biggest traders. So we still have, you know, plenty going for us, but we're not setting the trade agenda the way we did in the past. And that's a disappointment. And and U.S. companies are disadvantaged by this. Let's be honest. The fact that we're not in RCEP and we're not in CPTPP does not help our companies. It advantages the companies that are in countries that are part of those trading arrangements. So I think we're going to feel this more and more in the years to come. We're going to feel more disadvantaged, and there's going to be an increasing clamor for our political leadership to get its act together and once again lead on trade. That's my view. There are a lot of other trends at work in the United States, and politics of trade are pretty dysfunctional, but the economic imperative is real, and I think we're going to feel it, and we're going to have to react to it, and ultimately, our political leaders are going to have to react to it.
Well, I've always thought that if we're not in the game, and we want to market to those countries, well, I set up a manufacturing facility within those countries, so I take advantage of the free trade within that organization. So basically, we are exporting jobs, as far as I can tell, by doing this.
I agree with you. I think it's a mistake in terms of our economic future, and it's a strategic mistake to be doing that. We should be setting the agenda for trade. Since we're not, we've got to rely on Japan in particular, and when it comes to digital, Singapore, to set the highest standards so that there are good rules of the road for trade. But I would rather have the United States be setting that agenda than be outsourcing the trade agenda to other countries.
So I understand the detriment that we're under with the crash and burn of TPP, but when you talk to U.S. businesses, what do they say are the biggest obstacles to them doing business in Southeast Asia?
So U.S. businesses are worried about tax policies, naturally. They they want taxes to be lower wherever they're operating. They're worried about corruption. There is corruption in a lot of the countries where we operate, and U.S. companies operate under very strict anti-corruption rules. They worry about conflicting regulations, and they worry about instability. It's what you want for a really good business environment is predictable, stable rules, laws, regulations. And look, Asia's a complicated place. There's no Brussels. There's no, you know, like one organizing entity that sets the rules for the whole region. You have different rules. You cross the border and you've got a different set of rules. So that complexity is hard for business, but they're managing. You know, when we do decide to compete, we win. Our companies are competing and they're doing well in the region, and they're managing this complexity. But they would, of course, like more predictability, more stability in terms of rulemaking and regulations. They'd like to tackle the corruption problem head on, and some countries are doing that. And actually, even the IPEF is a contributor to that process. And they'd like to be able to compete on a level playing field, and they can't always. They sometimes are disadvantaged by local interests. But I see companies doing extremely well in Southeast Asia. So you know, you set us set a hard challenge to American business, and can usually rise to the occasion.
So before Jim jumps in, you mentioned IPEF, which of course is the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. What is that, and why is it useful?
It's a non-traditional trade framework because it doesn't include market access provisions. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example, was a more traditional trading arrangement, which included market access, which is the enticement to, because we're the biggest market in the world, that's the big enticement to bring countries in to a trade arrangement. And usually they'll pay the price of, you know, much higher standards for labor, environment, for, you know, the quality of trade, if they can get those market access provisions. What this administration is trying to do is, without offering market access provisions, still set the rules of the road. And it partially works. We're still the United States. We're now able to set the rules of the road more when it comes to supply chain resilience, to the energy transition, to dealing with tax challenges and corruption challenges, just by convening key countries, working with them to set those rules. There's a hunger for American leadership in the region. But I have to acknowledge it's not as effective as, say, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was. And right now, the trade pillar, this is the first and really most important portion of the IPEF, is on hold because of our politics, because no one really wants to fight this battle in the middle of an election year. And I regret that. I think it harms our businesses. It puts them at a disadvantage. And it's a problem of our own making. It's because we're not able to have really sensible discussions about trade in this political environment.
You know, Ted, when we were in Indonesia together, one of the issues our companies would talk about is the failure of infrastructure development, reliable electricity, reliable roads, reliable rail and airports. And you know, we worked together trying to solve that problem, but it was very, very difficult without U.S. government backing of some sort. And China stepped into the breach with their Belt and Road Initiative. And whether you think their projects are high quality or not, at least they're doing stuff. They built this new high-speed train between Jakarta and Bandung, for instance. And we're not there. Now, the new programs we keep announcing on green energy transition is a good idea, it seems to me. But I haven't seen a lot of American companies yet able to access this and do things. What do you think the disconnect is?
So we still aren't as organized as some of our competitors when it comes to tackling these challenges. The Japanese, for example, will often go in with a kind of turnkey project. Financing will be worked out. The solutions are worked out in advance. And that's very attractive to countries. We are doing some things in this area that I think are effective and are worth highlighting. And I'm going to, this is a little bit anecdotal, but let me cite the example of Secretary Gina Raimondo's recent trip to the Philippines. She led a presidential trade and investment mission. She was accompanied by Admiral Aquilino, head of Indo-PACOM. It was very interesting, kind of making the point that this is a whole of government effort. Economic security is national security and vice versa. We've got to look at the two together. And she used to lead a VC company, and she's got a really good sense of what will entice companies to make investments. She made a lot of calls before this trip, and she put together $1 billion worth of deals that were announced in Manila when we were there. It was really impressive. It was an example of when the U.S. government takes action, takes leadership, we can get stuff done, especially when it comes to a country like the Philippines, which is our ally, which is very open to U.S. investment, wants our companies to come. And I was able to help her a little bit on this trip and rope in some of our member companies, have them participate. It was impressive because it shows that when we act with unity of purpose, the U.S. government acts with unity of purpose, we get things done. There's a small agency, Trade Development Agency, TDA, led by Enwa Ibong, that is convening companies and officials in Manila in May 21st. They're doing similar things. They're looking for opportunities to round up financing from the big investors and make sure American companies are able to go in and talk about infrastructure projects and point to the financing for those projects and do kind of what the Japanese and others do and say, look, we've got a complete solution for you to this challenge you have, and American business will lead the way in resolving this problem, whether it's roads or ports or the infrastructure involved in the tech economy, the internet economy. So I do see things happening, and I think we need to encourage those, and we need to go more in the direction of a whole of government effort in support of American businesses. Because when our government's behind us, we're really effective. Our embassies, I think, can be very effective advocates for U.S. business. I took some U.S. ambassadors to New York and Chicago last week, and our ambassadors, you and I have seen this, Jim. Our ambassadors can be terrifically effective advocates for U.S. companies when they devote time and attention. And these ambassadors did and do. So I wanted to help them in that process of understanding the challenges our companies face and seeing the opportunities for assisting those companies. And they were all in, eager to learn, eager to find ways that they could be better advocates. And I like seeing that. And I think when we act with unity of purpose, we get stuff done. We nail down deals. We get contracts signed.
So while we were in Vietnam, Ted, Japan built a bridge and a road and made the trip to the airport a lot faster.
Yes, it's a beautiful bridge.
Such a nice bridge that all the Vietnamese young people would go out there on their motorbikes and cuddle and take pictures and those kinds of things. It's always, kind of a question amongst, people who sort of look at the United States. Why don't we do stuff like that? What is different about the Japanese system and our system that we, the United States, can't go and build somebody a bridge?
Well, we used to do it more than we do now. There was a time where those kind of investments by the United States and the involvement of our companies was, I think, more standard than it is now. I think one of the things that's happened is some of our companies, especially those involved in infrastructure, look at the complexities of Asia and they find it hard to navigate. In ASEAN, there are 10 countries, wildly different governing systems, lots of different languages, complex environments in which to navigate. And so they focused on things that they understand better, infrastructure in North America or in Europe. And I think that's a missing an opportunity when our companies do that. And I think there were ways in which we had more public financing for such projects in the past. USAID used to build bridges. I think it's been a long time since USAID invested in a lot of bridges. What we are very good at is investing in capacity building, in building the possibility of creating the possibility for people in the countries where we operate to move into the global economy, to take advantage of opportunities created by the internet economy. Actually, our tech companies are very good at building the infrastructure for the digital economy. There are some who say, well, the Chinese are eating our lunch on tech. I would challenge that. The infrastructure of the internet and the innovation that is required to take advantage of the internet economy, a lot of that is driven by our companies. Now, Amazon, Google, Meta, Apple, these are not the most popular companies these days, but they are active, present, engaged in Asia. They see opportunities there. They're engaged. I think they can outcompete Huawei, and they can outcompete the Chinese companies as long as they can operate on a level playing field. I was really interested to see Tim Cook in Vietnam recently. It's an open secret that Apple has been sourcing more of its materials and producing more in countries outside of China than it did in the past. But he went to Vietnam and was very visible about that. They're very actively investing in Vietnam. Now, Vietnam's manufacturing capacity is smaller than that of China, much smaller than that of China. So there are limits on the ability that the internet companies will have to get out of China and get to the rest of Asia, but they're doing it, and they're competing effectively in that realm. And I think the infrastructure of the internet is almost as important as ports and roads these days.
Speaking of Vietnam, I'm going to take you off our econ track just a little bit. Ray and I were on the call day before yesterday with the spokesperson for the Philippine Coast Guard in the aftermath of the water cannoning of a couple of Philippine Coast Guard vessels trying to resupply Philippine fishermen.
Yes.
Within the 200-mile economic zone of the Philippines.
Second Thomas Shoal, yep.
Exactly right. And Scarborough Shoal. And the commander said, because we asked him about ASEAN support, and he sort of lamented that ASEAN keeps quiet. And I was thinking of you and Vietnam, where our relationship is really good, and Vietnam has been harassed repeatedly by the Chinese, and yet they keep quiet. What do you think that's about?
Well, Vietnam hasn't entirely kept quiet. When the Philippines challenged Chinese assertions in 2016 and took them to the International Tribunal to say, you can't claim all of this big swath of the South China Sea. The Vietnamese joined the Philippines in that case, and against Chinese opposition. So they were actually pretty vocal on this. They've also been vocal in their desire to do more with us in the security realm than with any other country. They've had three aircraft carrier visits. They've had the largest ships in their fleet are donated by the United States. So they've made it clear where they stand when it comes to the South China Sea. They stand with us. And the Philippines has made it very clear they stand with us. And we've made it very clear we stand with them. I think President Biden, right about the time I was in Manila with Admiral Aquilino, President Biden made very clear what American commitments are to the Philippines in this sort of situation. Vietnam and the Philippines stand out in terms of their willingness and ability to be vocal in standing up to Chinese bullying. I'd say there's a real spectrum. At one end are countries like Vietnam and the Philippines. Another end are countries like Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar. They don't have an interest in the South China Sea, for one thing, and they have a heavy economic interest in China. They're supported economically by the Chinese. So they are not going to speak out against the Chinese on South China Sea. What's interesting are the countries in the middle. Malaysia and Indonesia also have stakes in the South China Sea. They also have EEZs in the South China Sea. They also have claims on islands and features in the South China Sea. And they have been trying to kind of play both sides. They are getting investment from China. Both countries are getting a lot of Chinese investment. Brunei, I would add to that list. And so they're more reluctant to speak out. So interests among the 10 ASEAN countries are not the same. And their willingness to stand up to Chinese bullying is not the same across that spectrum. And that, again, says, well, what should we do? Well, I think we have opportunities to work very closely with those countries in the middle and strengthen those relationships, those partnerships. You and I worked hard, Jim, to strengthen the ties with Indonesia. And I think Indonesia is a very important country. It's half of ASEAN's population, half of its economy. And the Indonesians have quietly stood up to the Chinese. They've shot and sunk Chinese ships in the sea around Natuna, which is an island that's part of Indonesia. So they act at times. The president-elect, who's currently the defense minister, has been very actively working with U.S. companies like Boeing and others to make sure that there's interoperability, and his military can work with the American military to deal with challenges to Indonesian sovereignty. It's different with Malaysia. Our relationship with Malaysia is not as close. Malaysia is an outspoken supporter of Hamas when it comes to the Middle East conflict. I think we could work harder to develop a strong relationship with Malaysia. So I think it's a dynamic situation, and no, ASEAN is not at all unified. They're also not unified on another challenge that the Chinese have posed, which is to the Mekong. It affects the livelihoods of hundreds of millions of people in mainland Southeast Asia. It's a complicated organization, ASEAN. It runs by consensus. It's creaky and inefficient. ASEAN will never be an EU, but it's actually an organization that works pretty well. It gets the right people in the room when decisions have to be made. It facilitates connections between all of these countries that used to be hammer and tongs fighting with each other all the time. Now they're not. They're mostly working together. And it's an organization whose existence is in the interest of a country like the United States.
So that brings us to sort of the million-dollar question. In our very first pilot podcast, Jim said that ASEAN is not a security organization, full stop. Yeah. And so what is ASEAN? And, I guess the million-dollar question is, what good is ASEAN?
So we look at some of the symbols of ASEAN, like, they have skits or, they get together, they have 1,200 meetings a year. We look at the way the organization operates, and we say, that's not very effective. They're not big decision makers. It's not focused on security. But I would still argue that it's an organization whose existence is in our interest, and that's because I mentioned the relationships that it creates, the interaction that occurs through those many meetings. And the fact that it has very often, the countries that are part of ASEAN have used the organization to deal with conflict between them. The Thais and the Cambodians, for example, don't agree on their maritime border. And ASEAN has effectively helped them manage that challenge. It was created to be an anti-communist bulwark, and the original members were all, you know, very interested in fighting communism. But now it includes Vietnam and Laos, two countries run by communist parties. It includes Cambodia and Myanmar. It's very diverse. And yet, what security organization in the Indo-Pacific includes all the key players? Well, the only one that does is the one that has ASEAN at the center. That's the East Asia Summit. That has all the key players of the Indo-Pacific. It has ASEAN at its center. It's the ASEAN nations that convene the other powers in the region, and they're very effective at it. They're very good. I think if you were saying, you know, well, it should be the Chinese who would bring everybody together or the Japanese, that's not going to work. Whereas with these smaller countries banded together, bring together the great powers of the Indo-Pacific, then you have a chance to have really good dialogues. And so we talk about ASEAN centrality. The U.S. government talks about ASEAN centrality. It's not because these are necessarily the biggest or the most important nations in the Indo-Pacific. It's because they're the ones that can convene everybody. They have to the extent there are centripetal forces in the Indo-Pacific, it's because ASEAN has created them. And you look at the Venn diagram of the various organizations that intersect in the Indo-Pacific, ASEAN's at the center of all those circles. I was so interested a few weeks ago when we had a new organization was created, a new trilateral arrangement was created, Japan, United States, Philippines. That's inventive and unique and interesting. And it includes three democracies that are allies, but it takes into account that the least developed of those democracies has economic needs. All three of them have security needs. And there's enough that we have in common that working in a trilateral arrangement, we can accomplish more. And there were announcements on infrastructure. We were talking about infrastructure earlier. There was a new Luzon Economic Corridor that was announced, some serious investments, serious commitments made in that trilateral arrangement that will benefit a key ASEAN nation. I think we have to be creative in Asia because of its diversity and because we have this intense competition going on with China. We have to be creative about the way we use organizations and arrangements like these trilateral arrangements or the Quad arrangement or other arrangements to get stuff done that will strengthen our position in that part of the world. And I think that's what we're doing.
All right, I'll ask you the final question. This is a tough one. You've lived in Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore. You've traveled widely throughout the region. I know you like to still travel because you were brave enough to take a Disney cruise with your kids. What is the one place in Southeast Asia you would visit on holiday?
So that would have to be Vietnam. I love
it. You're so transparent.
I am. I have very strong feelings for Vietnam. And I've lived in five Southeast Asian countries. I love traveling around the region, but we're going to be there again this summer. And where am I taking my kids? I'm taking them to Da Nang and Hoi An for the time that we have that's not official, when I don't have to work. Because I love Vietnam. And I think it comes from speaking the language and, you know, having spent so much time in Vietnam over the last 30 years, and having had the great privilege of being ambassador there, I'm accused sometimes of being a little bit biased towards Vietnam, and I'll acknowledge it. I really love Vietnam. Now, I love Indonesia. We've lived in Singapore. I love that. I love the whole region. I love living in Bangkok. I love the Philippines. But if you force me to choose one, I'm going to choose the one where I speak the language. I speak Vietnamese. I love Vietnam. I raised my children there. It would have to be Vietnam.
Well, I will tell you, Ted, I tell this story a lot about people who learn other languages. I learned Vietnamese when I was 19 years old as a junior enlisted airman, and I learned to speak it correctly, phonetically correctly. You, sir, did not. Your vocabulary outstrips mine because you are bold. I will sit there and agonize about how I should say this or that, and will never actually say anything because I'm afraid to screw it up. And you did it the correct way. You would just plow in.
I make mistakes. I just plunge in and I use it, and they're very forgiving because I make lots of mistakes, but the fact that I'm trying so hard, they give me a lot of credit for.
And that is the way to do it. And I learned a lot from watching you do that. Even though I would chuckle to myself about the fact that your phonetics were not exactly correct.
Yeah, so, but people understood me. If they understand 90% of what I'm saying, that's enough. And if I understand 90% of what they're saying, that's also enough. Because then I can ask questions and, you know, ferret out that last 10% or get some help. I'm terrible at writing in Vietnamese, but I'm not so bad at listening and understanding what people are trying to convey to me. And I think that matters for a diplomat, to be able to hear what your interlocutor wants to say.
I think you're absolutely right. And as I said, I learned a lot from watching you operate. So Ted Osius, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to see you again. It's been an education for me. This is, as you know, I'm a defense guy. This is not my field, but it's been...
You've been taking it very well.
I fake it till I make it, sir.
Well, look, it was really fun for me. I love talking to two people whom I admire and like, enjoyed working with, and I'm happy to... feels like a conversation among friends.
Well, thanks, Ted. It's been a pleasure. Well, Jim, that was a lot of fun. It was good to see Ted again. And, you know, we didn't give him a chance, but of course he wrote a book. He wrote a book. He was very proud of his time in Vietnam. It was kind of the culmination, I think, of his career. And so his book is Nothing is Impossible, talking about the strides that we made, reconciling with Vietnam. I know it was, you know, remarkable for me as a military officer to be in a place, you know, looking at that, you know, red flag with a big yellow star on it and thinking, wow, these are our partners now. We're, you know, I mean, I grew up with the idea that these were our enemies, and, you know, we're actually partners with that country.
Yeah. You know, as you can tell from this podcast, Ted is a passionate man who is passionate about Vietnam, and it absolutely comes through in his book.
Yeah.
So it's worth taking a look at.
Well, you and Ted served together in Indonesia. So is your story, it's your turn to do a There I Was story. Is your story about Indonesia, perchance?
Well, it's about Indonesia and Ted, since it seems apropos. So as you can tell, Ted is a very personable man with a lot of charisma. And we were talking to a very wealthy billionaire Indonesian fellow. And we had a tradition of every month or so, he invited us out to a hotel bar where we would take over a private room, order a bottle of the most expensive cognac they had, and we would drain the bottle. And the more he drank, the angrier he got. He would get angry at American policy, at what we were wearing, at the traffic, but mostly about American policy. The amazing thing was he never got mad at Ted. It was always me. And Ted would laugh and laugh as I got abused. So it taught me patience and the qualities of having the right wingman.
Well, I guess, I mean, that really makes, I mean, that sort of brings it all home, because Ted was just such a unique personality. He, you know, I always remember him as having the worst Vietnamese pronunciation I could imagine, because he didn't learn in school at an early age the way I did. So I pronounced words correctly. But his vocabulary was far and away better than mine because he just plowed right in. And he was not afraid. He was not ashamed. He would just sort of, and they loved him. You know, they loved him there. So I was, I think, mostly invisible just because I didn't have that boldness.
Yeah. Ted just goes for it. Anyway, it was fun. It was hopefully informative to our audience. Look forward to our next one.
All right. Well, we've got another one coming up this week as well. So it's a big week. We're going to be talking about Taiwan soon. But thank you to our listeners. Please don't forget to like and subscribe and all of those things. It really helps us out. Our audience is growing rapidly, and I'm looking forward to our next one. So for Jim, I'm Ray, and thanks for listening.